Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Trucking, got my chips cashed in, keep trucking. Like the doodah man, together, more or less in line, just keep trucking on.
Word came last week the surviving members of the Grateful Dead will reunite for three big concerts in Chicago this summer, could well be their last. In the 50th anniversary year of one of history's most successful bands, we're looking back at the cultural history of their long, strange trip. This hour on Point, the Grateful Dead. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How do you see, hear, celebrate, run from the Grateful Dead? What's the heart of their ecstatic, enduring appeal? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from San Francisco is Peter Richardson. He teaches humanities and American studies at San Francisco State University. His new book is No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. Peter Richardson, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
You say that back in the mid-70s, the young Peter Richardson and your friends were inclined to dismiss the Grateful Dead in the 1970s as relics. Here we are, it's 2015, and they've got a comeback concert, maybe a finale coming.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And, you know, the mid-70s was the time of their brief hiatus. Music was kind of moving on, and many people in the press and the media generally were thinking of the Grateful Dead as a nostalgia act, and they had many more great years to come.
You describe the mainstream media as depicting the Grateful Dead as grizzled hippie throwbacks with a cult following of burned-out stoners. You say never especially accurate, this stereotype had become a handy synodosh for the 1960s. What, the Grateful Dead standing for what, Peter?
Well, I think they stood for the San Francisco counterculture of the 1960s. And, of course, what I try to point out in the book is that, you know, they were very successful more than two decades after Woodstock. So just seeing them as a symbol of the 60s misses a big part of their story. And a big part of their story actually stretches back to the 1950s and the mid-century San Francisco art scene. So it's really a story about the second half of the 20th century in America, as seen through the Grateful Dead and their project.
I want to look at that story, that cultural history. It's a wonderful story that you tell. Think with us for just a second about this series of what, three or four concerts are going to give at Soldier Field this summer in Chicago. This was the last place they all played together with Jerry Garcia, who died in 1995. Who's playing? What's happening? They've got also Trey Anastasio from Phish joining them. Just explain what's going to happen this summer, Peter.
Well, they're putting together a three-show stand at Chicago's Soldier Field, which I'm sure was selected because it's easy for the fans on both coasts to get to, and from the South, they have many fans there. And but also, as you say, it commemorates their 1995 performance, so one of the last of the big stadium performances that they had. They'll have Bruce Hornsby along with Trey Anastasio. They'll have Jeff Cometti. And, you know, who knows who they'll bring out, but it's the core four, as they say. It's not exactly all the surviving members of the Grateful Dead, but they have Mickey Hart and Phil Lesh and Billy Kreutzmann and Bob Weir. And, you know, it promises to be a really fabulous show. And I know it's taken a lot of time and energy to put it together and to make all the arrangements. None of this was easy. A lot of people were saying this was going to happen for sure. People were getting kind of skeptical, and then came the announcement. And there's a lot of excitement. It practically broke the internet as far as the Deadheads were concerned.
And you can be sure there will be buses and planes and everything else coming in from all over the place. Of course, Jerry Garcia won't be there. Is it the Dead without him?
I think, in a way, they've avoided calling themselves the Grateful Dead ever since the death of Jerry Garcia in 1995. They've called themselves the Dead. They've called themselves the Other One. They've had this kind of fluid lineup, and every once in a while they perform together. They performed at Barack Obama's inauguration, but not much altogether since then. So there's a lot of excitement around it, and they have a lot of time to put this together and work it all out. And anyway, I know it wasn't easy, and a lot of people are glad to see it.
You've got sort of three big sections to your book, which you say go to the heart of the Grateful Dead project. And they're evocative. But number one, ecstasy. Number two, mobility. Number three, community. I want to dig into that 50s history that lies beneath all of this. But help us with those three big banners you hang over the Grateful Dead.
Well, the first one is ecstasy. And I that's not the drug, obviously. It's the urge for transcendence and what the Dead called getting high. It didn't always have to do with drugs. Of course, it overlapped heavily with drug culture in the 1960s, especially LSD, which was legal when the Grateful Dead started taking it and going to Ken Kesey's acid tests, which were big kind of weekend parties that just grew and grew and grew and kind of culminated with the Trips Festival here in San Francisco.
And not just going to those acid tests. They were sort of the house band for those acid tests.
They were very much the house band, but it was a very kind of kinetic party scene that wasn't a performance in the typical sense of the word. And sometimes they didn't play much at all. But the partying was so energetic that they really saw it as a kind of template for the kind of scene that they wanted, the kind of audience participation, the kind of loose, unstructured, high experience that they were seeking. And that became a kind of template for getting it on properly, as Jerry Garcia once put it.
It was described as counterculture, but you see in that urge for the ecstatic, for rapture, for the utopian, a kind of classic American story, Peter.
Right. They picked up some of this from the Beats as well as Ken Kesey. They were all big Jack Kerouac fans. And if you go back and read On the Road with Jack Kerouac or the Dharma Bums, you'll see that there was this incredible emphasis on intense experience. And that really inspired the Dead individually and then later collectively. And they managed to sort of create a larger social space for the expression of those countercultural values, bigger than, Jack Kerouac's car or Ken Kesey's bus. You know, this was the kind of event that more and more people couldn't participate in. And one person, Nick Merriweather, the Grateful Dead archivist at UC Santa Cruz, calls the democratization of bohemia. And it's a very specific form of bohemia, but I think that was a large part of the Dead's appeal.
Peter, take us back to that bay scene in the 1950s. You describe part of what you're up to here is just trying to understand the Bay Area milieu that you were born into, that the Grateful Dead was born out of. Take us into that cultural root ball. Spend a little time with us there.
Well, the Second World War really changed the San Francisco Bay Area. And Jerry Garcia was born in 1942. And most of the band members were born in a few year period during that time. So there's this very, kind of baby boomer kind of experience. And that all transformed the San Francisco Bay Area and its art scene, which was very small and insular, but very vital. And Jerry Garcia happened to come across, almost stumble upon that scene. He was bored by school. He wasn't doing great there, but he was a good illustrator. So he signed up for art classes at what's now the San Francisco Art Institute, and he met his first bohemians, really. Mm-hmm. And he never went back. And that was a very, very formative experience for him, not only in terms of how to think about art, but in how to live like an artist.
He knew the bar scene from his youth. His family had run one.
Yes, they had a bar. I'm in San Francisco right now. They had a bar not far from here on Rincon Hill that served sailors and longshoremen and warehousemen who populated the what's called the Embarcadero here in San Francisco, the docks and Skid Row. And so Jerry Garcia's parents opened a bar about 4 years after the repeal of Prohibition. And I think he was very much shaped by that experience as well. So there was this sort of freewheeling quality that he grew up with. And, that was another part of another dimension, I think, of the Dead's project. I think in many ways, I argue in the book that you can really trace the Dead's project, in outline anyway, back to a few events that occurred between Jerry Garcia's 15th and 16th birthdays.
We'll go back to those. We'll do it right after a break. How would you describe mm-hmm. the project itself, the Grateful Dead project?
It was like a 30-year art project. You know, music was a big part of it, but I think if you're just looking at the songbook, you're going to miss a huge part of what made the Dead so appealing to so many people. I think there was a lot more to it, the way they ran their organization, the values, and just kind of the underlying utopian ideals that drove and propelled that project.
What did Jerry Garcia say they were up to?
Well, at one point he said, you know, he was very attracted to rock and roll, but that they were, at that time, they were just kind of guys banging around on instruments. And he said he wanted to make it something that the people at the Art Institute would get into, too. Which is, he only said it once, but it's very revealing, I think, that he was looking for something, a way to channel those impulses that he had, his deep love of music and all forms of American roots music, and to turn that into something that they could sustain and also build what he used to call the hip economy.
Ecstasy, mobility, community, and the Grateful Dead. Peter Richardson writes it all up in his wonderful new book, No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. News last week that they will have a kind of 50th anniversary, maybe finale concert or series of three concerts in Chicago this summer. Peter Richardson, stand by in San Francisco. Listeners, you can join us. We're talking about the Grateful Dead one more time here. Did you grow up, drop out with the Grateful Dead? Did you come to them late in their run? Did you swim upstream from Fish to the Grateful Dead? What do you hear, see in this legendary band? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Grateful Dead one more time. Their very likely last concerts have just been announced this summer, Chicago. We're looking at the story behind the band's amazing run. My guest is Peter Richardson. His new book is No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. You can join us this hour. What do you hear, see in this legendary band? Grizzled old hippies lost in a daze? Or the path to joy, ecstasy, freedom? Is Peter Richardson right? Has the Dead's quest been, in a way, a classic American quest for utopia? And are you a Deadhead? Will you be in Chicago? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Peter Richardson joins us from San Francisco. Peter, lots of people calling in already. Jim in Cleveland, Ohio. Jim, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Jim, you're on.
Hey. Yeah, really excited about this. Going to take my 14-month-old to his, well, I really don't want to call it a Dead show, because without Jerry, it's not the Dead. But I'm super excited to see Trey playing with him. Anyone should look up on YouTube Shakedown Street with those guys. It's fantastic. My question is, one quick comment. Huge fan since 1988. Huge fan of Fish as well. My question is, why wasn't Vince Welnick invited? I'm not the biggest Vince fan, but he was part of the band. And the other thing is, I agree with your guest that it's so much more than just the music. I'm not going to get all spiritual, but it is more than the music, and I'm really looking forward to it. And so the question is, what happened to Vince?
We'll get the question, but one for you. Did you say, Jim, in Cleveland, you're going to take your 14-month-old to the Dead concert?
Heck yeah, Tom.
And what will your 14-month-old get from it?
What is he going to get from it?
Yeah.
Come on. I was I went to a Tina Turner show in my mom's room when I was a kid. I don't know what I got from it, but I know they need to go, and he's going to go because I'd rather him do that than Taylor Swift and all that other crap.
Hey, I love it. Jim, thanks for your call. Vince Welnick, keyboard player with the Grateful Dead. Peter Richardson, why not this summer?
Well, Vince Welnick passed away, and so that's probably the number one reason. But
that's a pretty full stop.
Yeah, he passed away shortly before they announced a deal that they made with their current legacy label, and he had not been included in some of the other shows, and I think he was deeply disappointed by that. But they are going to have some great keyboards at these shows, and I think a lot of people, probably including Jim, is looking forward to that. And I agree completely with him that it's more than the music here. It's really that, you know, the community's urge to commune, and that's what these shows are going to provide.
Take us back to that Jerry Garcia summer, his 15th, 16th year, you say was so foundational for what came out in The Grateful Dead ultimately and back into that cultural scene.
Well, he signed up for art class, and that was the introduction to art and how to live like an artist. His teacher was Wally Hedrick, and who was a painter and sculptor, and he taught him how what art was all about, and that was something very new for Jerry Garcia. So that was the first thing. What's now the San Francisco Art Institute? Through Wally Hedrick, Jerry Garcia learned about Jack Kerouac, and he read On the Road. So that was the second thing, and that was very inspirational to Jerry Garcia and the other members of the band as well. The third thing was that he smoked marijuana for the first time, which he far preferred to alcohol, and he said that was right up his alley. And the fourth thing was he got his first guitar, a Dan Electro, for his 15th birthday. He actually got an accordion, which he begged his mother to trade for a Dan Electro electric guitar. And he started playing with that. And you know, it was out of tune. It had some kind of weird open tuning, and it took him 6 months to figure out that, you know, he was just kind of hacking around. But he never gave up on it. And he also learned how to play the banjo shortly after that and got into folk music. And I mean, but it just, that those four things really opened him out to a new world, and he never really went back to the straight world.
The names that swirl around the origins of this band and that culture, Kerouac and Ken Kesey, Neil Cassidy, who was part of the Grateful Dead circle, and the Hell's Angels, we'll get to that. Also, Harry Smith in that famous anthology of American folk music that he brought out originally in 1952. You call that music hugely influential in the sort of trajectory of the Grateful Dead. Here's a little bit. This is from that album, for that set. This is Minglewood Blues by Cannon's Jug Stompers. This was recorded in 1928. Harry Smith brought it back in his anthology. Don't you never let one woman rule your mind. You describe the Grateful Dead and many others at that time really yearning back to this sound and, I don't know, sort of a wild, free, weird America, Peter.
Right. That's what Grail Marcus called the old, weird America. He was riffing on poet, San Francisco poet Kenneth Rexroth, who called it the old, free America. But its very weirdness was really what attracted Jerry Garcia, and also Robert Hunter, who was very influenced by the folk revival of the 1950s and early 60s. So that was their first great love, was this folk music. And Harry Smith's anthology was a kind of portal to this lost world. You know, before the war, agrarian, it already sounded old when that music, when it came out, already sounded old.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it was amazing to Hunter and Garcia that this music had been recorded and sold within living memory. It was not that long before the war that these albums were cut. So they very eagerly delved into that music and absorbed it and all of its mystery and strangeness. And remember, this is all before magazines like Rolling Stone were out, who were talking about, you know, who your influences should be. They had to seek these influences out.
They followed
that weird interest. And interestingly, another person who was doing it almost halfway across the country was Bob Dylan, with whom they would later play.
Yeah, of course, with his Woody Guthrie fascination. The Grateful Dead seeing it in part as an antidote to what conformity and suburbia that was setting in so strong after World War II. All of that gets turbocharged as they get deeper into drug awareness. And I was really struck in here by your description. Robert Hunter, who would come to write lyrics for the Grateful Dead, was one of those. Ken Kesey another, but who worked with people in the government as a volunteer getting drugs, getting LSD, acid. Hunter was what? He was with a kind of guinea pig for the U.S. Army on mescaline experiments. What were those, Peter?
Well, they were experiments at the VA hospital down on the peninsula where he lived at the time. Ken Kesey also participated in those experiments, and that experience really influenced A One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which came out in 1962 and sort of charged this whole Ken Kesey and Mary Prankster and acid test scene. But Hunter was another one of those test subjects. So he was a very early user of some of these psychoactive drugs under clinical conditions. And, you know, it was just one of those ironic things that part of our Cold War, military research included the testing of this drug, which would later be, you know, pretty well ignite the counterculture of the 1960s.
It is pretty wild. The U.S. Army and the CIA strapping these volunteers into chairs, and then Robert Hunter sits there with tears coming out of his eyes and describes that he imagined himself inhabiting the body of this great green Buddha who had a pool in his lap, and the pool was running through my eyes. And you very quickly feel kind of close to Grateful Dead lyrics there. He went Dionysian with this, sort of the Grateful Dead. I wonder if you'd read a little bit for us, though, just to get a sense of how of the weirdness of this coming out of a very sort of military power projection sense of what might be in this world of psychoactive drugs. Could you read a bit just from that portion of No Simple Highway, Peter?
Sure. If Hunter's personal project was Dionysian, a new version of Arthur Rimbaud's systematic derangement of the senses, the Pentagon's mission was both Apollonian and Martian. Certainly, the officer in charge of developing chemical weapons regarded his research program as the height of enlightened warfare. The alternative to these weapons, he noted in a 1959 magazine article, would be even more savage. Quote, "I do not contend that driving people crazy, even for a few hours, is a pleasant prospect, but warfare is never pleasant. And to those who feel that any kind of chemical weapon is more horrible than conventional weapons, I put this question. Would you rather be temporarily deranged, blinded, or paralyzed by a chemical agent, or burned alive by a conventional firebomb?" Unquote. So went the dark logic of the Cold War. When it came to the arms race, the U.S. government wasn't taking any chances, except with the minds of its test subjects. Meanwhile, the Pentagon was funding a vast array of other research programs, including the development of more powerful nuclear weapons in the San Francisco Bay Area. The drug research was a tiny part of this effort, but it produced the most unlikely outcome of all. In less than a decade, this exotic form of defense spending would ignite the 1960s counterculture. Curious about Hunter's experience, Garcia and David Nelson took him out for coffee and pressed him for details. Hunter reported only one hallucination. A chair had barked at him. But another illusion was more nightmarish. He imagined that a demon was chasing him with a dagger. Finally, Hunter faced his assailant, wrested the dagger out of his hand, stabbed himself in the heart, and licked the blood off the dagger. "God," Garcia said, "I've got to have some of that."
Back to the beginning with Peter Richardson, reading there from his new book, No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. Does it show up in the music? Here's The Grateful Dead, 1966, Live at the Matrix with Cream Puff War.
Wait a minute, what were you doing with your time?
their Cream Puff War, 1966. This was not long after they'd just been called the Warlocks, now the Grateful Dead. How important were the psychoactive, psychedelic drugs early in their career, their band history, Peter?
Oh, I think it was very important. I think it sort of catapulted them out of the bar band scene into a very fertile San Francisco art scene that also included psychedelic poster art. Many of those artists were very attracted to Grateful Dead because of their name and all of the imagery and iconography that it summoned up. But I don't think, you know, you would have the 1960s San Francisco counterculture without that kind of experimentation. And don't forget that the drug was still illegal until the fall of 1966.
There was this sort of free period right there. And I'd never read Owsley Stanley, the famous kind of a super LSD guru from those times, was one of the early backers financially.
That's right. He took them down to Los Angeles and put them up in a house and paid for all their food and so on, a lot of equipment as well. You know, when they didn't have a lot of income coming in. He had attended an acid test, was very impressed by the Dead, in fact, frightened by the Dead and their music, and really saw it as a kind of extension of his business. And, you know, he was an important part of the sound system conceiving of the sound system, especially, that the Dead eventually produced, which was quite legendary, so that when they went out on the road, they had this incredible fidelity, which made the concert experience a very rich one for their fans.
Owsley Stanley, instrumental from a few different angles there, the electronics exterior and almost interior. It's funny how many different origin stories there are for the name Grateful Dead, and then also maybe it's logical, but the iconography, the graphics, the skeleton with the roses coming out of the Rubaiyat, Omar Khayyam.
Right. You know, Garcia was always very tuned in to the visual arts going back to his own education. But the artists, when interviewed, almost always comment on the incredible number of ideas that they got from the name, which I think it's pretty well clear now that Jerry Garcia picked it out of a reference work one day. They realized that there was another band recording under the name of the Warlocks. They had to pick another name. And one day they just went over to Phil Lesh's house, and there was a Funkin' Wagnalls lying around, and Garcia opened it and saw this phrase, the Grateful Dead, which is the name of a folk motif. You know, when folklorists were putting together their research, starting in the 19th century, they saw these points of contact in these very, very different kinds of folk traditions and began naming them and categorizing them. And one of those names was the Grateful Dead, and that's where the name comes from.
And the iconography itself from an old volume of Omar Khayyam's Rubaiyat.
Right. So Stanley Mouse and Alton Kelly were supposed to do a poster for the Grateful Dead for a performance. They went over to the San Francisco Public Library reference room, started pulling out old books, and they saw an edition of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, a translated edition of the Persian poet, who very much encouraged his readers to live life and, you know, get high in their own way. And they basically took one of those images that they saw in the book, and they put a few overlays on it, and it became one of the most important psychedelic posters of that period.
Skeleton full of roses, but the message, live life. Peter Richardson's new book is No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. Listeners, you can join us this hour. Lots lined up. We'll come to your calls. We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. What do you hear, see in the long, long story of the Grateful Dead? Back this summer for three concerts in Chicago, maybe their last. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
What I want to know, how does the song go? Come hear Uncle John's band by the riverside. Got some things to talk about here beside the rising tide. Come hear Uncle John's band playing to the tide. Come on along.
take his children home.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Grateful Dead. Behind us here playing in the band from 1971, Grateful Dead, Skull and Roses, self-titled 71 album. Peter Richardson is with us from San Francisco State University, author of the new book, No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. They will play three concerts this summer in Chicago, maybe their last, 50 years after this band was put together. Big claims in this book. Peter Richardson talking about the Grateful Dead emerging from the vibrant San Francisco art scene, grabbing national attention, pioneering, he writes, a new and ecstatic form of expression called the rock concert. Imagine being the creator of that. Three decades after that, the nation's most popular touring band. A long, long run by the Grateful Dead. You can join us at 800-423-8255. Peter Richardson's in San Francisco. Ray is with us from Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Hi, Ray. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. I'm one of the people that lived through that part of it. I was born and raised in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. My father would send me out during the summers to Los Angeles or San Francisco to see relatives. What's interesting about this is the Grateful Dead, as they were trying to formulate their band, they were kind of like a garage band back then. They were playing in the parks and in bars, and just where anybody would have them. In fact, Jefferson Airplane was living two blocks from my aunt's place on Fulton Street. So it's just amazing to see how they all started and formulated. Well, Jerry got this idea. He says, well, we got to get a little well-known here. And he was in the street. People kind of knew him and that. So he went down to Los Angeles to Laurel Canyon, and my other aunt lived near there, and they had a lot of recording studios back then. And John Mayall took interest in him, and that's got things going. But what's really interesting is when they were playing at some of their concerts in San Francisco, they played with Iron Butterfly, Strawberry Alarm Clock, the Troggs. And, you know, it was just interesting to see how all that came about and just how they grew with that and being part of it. Also on those LSD experiments, it was Sandoz pharmaceutical liquid L25 in vials that they were using. And what they would do with that is they would stick a pin in the vial and stick it in the people's tongues. And that was part of that military experiment. But getting back to Jerry Garcia, and one of the earlier albums, Working Man's Dead, was quite, I think, a beginning part of getting them more well-known on the circuit. But anyways, it's just exciting that you have this on and to relive this. And yes, I'm going to the concert, and whatever. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. Headed to Chicago, the summer from Rhinelander. It was an incredible ferment at that time, Peter. Our caller lays it out, but you've got it in the book. All these bands and names and people from the literary to the rock world that would become so well known in what seemed like a pretty small petri dish of the Bay Area at that time.
It really was. I mean, it carried on that kind of small but vital art scene of the 1950s, but it reached a kind of national audience for the first time. And for a brief time, I would say for about 10 years, San Francisco became a rock capital of the world in many ways, to rival London and New York and other places like that. And, you know, don't forget, at this time, too, Rolling Stone magazine was founded. I think their first issue was November 1967. And they ran, in their first issue, they ran a story on the Grateful Dead, who were arrested at their home at 710 Ashbury on drug possession. So from the very beginning, this before Rolling Stone became what it is today, but from the very beginning, they were an important part of the San Francisco arts community, not just the music community. But they were only in San Francisco for about a year and a half. San Francisco has continued to claim them for good reason. But of course, after 1968, the Dead moved over the Golden Gate Bridge and lived in a much more bucolic setting up in Marin County. I would say Ray is exactly right. Working Man's Dead was their first commercially successful studio album. And then they were able to build the touring machine behind that album, as well as American Beauty, which came out the same year and has most of these kind of beloved classic studio, you know, songs that people associate with the Dead, as opposed to the long improvised jams that were part, you know, that were their signature, really, in which the aficionados are more attracted to.
By 1968, you had Robert Hunter in there as a lyricist, he who had been the subject of those military psychoactive drug tests. Here's one of his songs that he wrote, Dark Star, from 1968.
Dark Star crashes, holding its light into ashes.
And maybe you can hear a little bit of that Robert Hunter psychedelia right there. Carmen in Omaha, Nebraska. Carmen, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hello. I'm very excited to see. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to go, but I got into the Dead probably the late 70s, early 80s. And my theory, and Mr. Richardson can tell me if this is accurate or not, but it seems to me that the reason that they appeal to so many people is the background of each of the members. It seems like their music background was blues when Pigpen was with them still, and folk, classic, rock, and it just came together in a really amazing way that appealed to so many different people that like all different kinds of music. And as far as the concerts go, there was, I mean, everybody, it's an amazing experience because everybody's just so nice. And I don't know if it's because they're all, you know, everybody was high, but, you know, people were just kind. And how the Dead let everybody, you know, tape their shows, and people would trade tapes, and, you know, it just built a real sense of community.
Carmen, I'm so glad for your call. Mobility and community were the two other big themes of your book, Peter. Speak to what was created on the road. You say this, more than the studio albums, was really the heart of the Grateful Dead experience.
Right. After they had some commercial success with Working Man's Dead and American Beauty, they were able to tour nationally on a regular basis. And that became not only part of their operation, but it also became part of their mythology, because they also wrote about the romance of the open road. So if you think of which they picked up from the Beats in many ways and sort of extended forward into the 1960s and 70s, and if you think about a song like Truckin' or I Know You Rider or many, many other kind of road songs that the Grateful Dead are known for, that sense of mobility and the open road and just sort of these open vistas created a kind of wanderlust, I think, that was then imparted to the Deadheads that would travel with them and share those annual migrations with them. And that was unique. I mean, not very many bands had fans that would follow them on the road and create that community that Carmen was talking about, a nice community where people treated each other, for the most part, pretty well. And so I think that sense of the community communing was an important part of the success for the Grateful Dead over time, especially because as the music, you know, waxed and waned, the community grew and expanded in force. And that was super important, especially in the period that Carmen is talking about. She's also quite right that this, you know, very wide, this very large musical palette that the Dead drew on, all kinds of American roots music. She mentioned some of them, but it's really this incredible breadth that they were trying to, you know, this all of these different musical streams that they were trying to draw into their own music. So, you know, that kept the music fresh. They were always trying something new. They didn't turn into a nostalgia act. In fact, they were very committed to improvisation. So if you went to three shows on three consecutive nights, you weren't going to hear the same show. You weren't even going to hear the same song. So they would, even if they were the same numbers, they would be played differently. And I don't mean one person improvising on top of the rest of the band, but everybody improvising at the same time. I mean, that's very exciting. And so you could go back to show after show, and, you know, each show took on its own sort of cast. And that, when people began taping the shows and then trading those tapes, you know, there was the, it became a kind of alternative currency in the Grateful Dead community.
Here's one of those. This is from 1977. This was live at Cornell University in Barton Hall here, sort of a legendary night of Grateful Dead performance and community. Here's some of the song Scarlet Begonias. Peter Richardson in San Francisco, I don't know if non-deadheads can entirely hear what got fans so excited in a setting like that with this band.
Well, a lot of it was being there, and of course the tapes were a kind of permanent record of that in-the-moment sort of improvisation. And it's a little bit paradoxical, right? This was a band that was dedicated to the moment of performance and improvisation. And yet it spawned an incredible number of tapes and recordings that circulated and were copied and so on and so forth, so that they could be listened to later, not in that moment. Not everybody sees that as a paradox, but I think that there's something interesting about that. And another important thing about the Dead is that they allowed taping. They allowed their fans to tape their performances. And Garcia said, with typical kind of brio, you know, when we're done with the music, they can do with it whatever they want, meaning that it was okay to tape it and trade those tapes. And that turned out to be a shrewd move because that kind of consolidated the community that was growing and starting to follow the Dead. And through the 70s and 80s, you know, people were listening to those tapes just as eagerly as they were listening to the studio recordings and the live albums.
Robert in Governor, New York. Robert, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Tom. I want to take I guess an opposite tact here. I have a problem with the romanticizing of the Grateful Dead and Ken Kesey and Dr. Timothy Leary and the whole thing, because the bottom line is they caused a huge amount of destruction to a whole generation of young people back then, and I believe one of the things that made them so potent was they actually were a religion. You might call it an alternative religion. And I believe that, I could be wrong about this, I know I'm talking to some experts here, but I believe the term acid rock kind of started with the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead. And
Robert, what's the destruction that's on your mind here? What a destruction exactly?
Well, LSD was the main message, actually, or what the Grateful Dead and all these other people were saying, that by the ingestion of hallucinogens, specifically LSD, one could have a religious experience or a mind expansion. And those two things were an incredible temptation to a bunch of young people of that era that were looking for some answers that they weren't finding in their traditional thought.
And what about more libertarian Americans who might say, yeah, that's what they were suggesting, and free country, why not?
Because scrambled brains are not good. I went to a doctor. You know, I myself... was part of the culture, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
And I went to my medical doctor, and I just, you know, I really trusted this fellow, and I told him, I said, I happened to mention that I had dropped some LSD, and his whole demeanor changed. He looked at me like he was looking at the Wolfman, and he got some pictures out that he, I don't know where he got these pictures, but they were pictures of brain cells. You know, normal brain cells as opposed to those who were under the influence of LSD. And there was a visible, you know, difference. It looked like scrambled eggs.
Robert, we've got it. Peter Richardson, our time is short. Robert's channeling his doctor there. Channel some Jerry Garcia in response to that complaint.
Well, there's two things I think you could say. One is that the dead never made any bones about the fact that this bohemian life that they chose and that some of their and some of their fans chose was not an easy life. I mean, if you really look at Robert Hunter's lyrics, they're full of cautionary tales about this life. And so I think a little bit of extra further study would maybe tweak Robert's point, which has been made many times and was made a lot when Jerry Garcia passed away in 1995 by more conservative cultural critics. The other thing I think you need to do is to set the Dead's project against a particular backdrop, and that's the backdrop of the war on drugs. How it was conceived, why it was conceived, how it was waged, starting with the Nixon administration and then militarized in the Reagan administration. And I think in a way it might temper some of that criticism that people direct at the Dead. And especially if you look at what the Dead themselves said about drug use over time. They were asked many, many questions about it over the years. And there's a long record that you can get into, or you can take the easy way out and just read my book, which has some of that in there.
Was freedom their response?
Yeah, I think they really loved that part of the American tradition, that freedom. And you can't really understand the Dead's success unless you see how they tapped into that kind of inexhaustible utopian energy that's such an important part of America. Even though it's not a... That's why I called the book No Simple Highway. It's not a simple answer. It's not a simple life. But it's a fascinating one. And you, as I say, you don't have to like their music to love their story.
Peter Richardson tells a story in full complexity in his book No Simple Highway. Grateful Dead, back together this summer. The Core 4 and more in Chicago. Peter Richardson, thank you very much for being with us today. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, great to have you here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
And it's just a box of rain or a ribbon for your hair. Such a